Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Katie Herzog and Jesse Single on the podcast. Herzog's writing has appeared in an array of publications, and she is a former staff writer at the Seattle alt-weekly The Stranger. Single is a contributing writer at New York Magazine, where he previously edited Science of Us, a behavioral science vertical. He also has a newsletter where he writes about behavioral science, media, and other stuff. The other stuff part being a lot of other stuff. His book about half-baked viral psychology, The Quick Fix, is coming out in about a year. Together, Herzog and Single co-host the Blocked and Reported podcast. So great to chat with you today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Do we have anything to discuss today?
How's the weather where you are?
Yeah, the weather is beautiful, actually, so please don't hate me. But you're making a lot more money than I am, so...
I don't know about that.
We can discuss the above-ground pool I have planned with our Patreon earnings.
Yeah. I was wondering what, like, the next stretch goal is. Like, if you hit $10,000 a month, you guys will donate half the proceeds to the Psychology Podcast? Is that it?
Yeah, that was under discussion, yeah, of course, naturally. Yeah.
I think right now the only plan is that Jesse's going to make pizza for every single one of our listeners if we hit $10,000 a month.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Can it be gluten-free? Some of it gluten-free?
Absolutely. Scott, that is blasphemy. Gluten-free pizza. Come on.
Well,
you're going to lose us some Patreon subscribers, Jesse.
But you'll get the celiac people loving you. Okay.
True.
Trust me.
That's true.
And that would include me. Okay, so look, I want to actually start off and ask you guys where you first met each other, because it occurred to me the other day, I was like, was I witnessing the origin story? Remember we went to the bar after that Heterodox Academy conference, and you guys were just so intensely talking to each other, and I was like, and I kept looking over to talk to you two, and you two were so intense that I was just like, I'm just going to let you two be. Is that one of the first times you two talked to each other?
In person, I think, right? But Katie, didn't you originally reach out to me because we were writing a story on the same subject?
Well, so I reached out to you while I was working on a piece about detransition because I'd read your work. And part of the story that I thought that I was working on had a section about sort of backlash to talking about detransition stories, which didn't ultimately make it in the piece. And I don't think it needed to be in the piece, but it was sort of my way of like hedging against criticism, was to add like all these stories about people who had written about trans issues in a way that sort of got them dogpiled for whatever reason. And so I reached out to you, Alice Drager, a few other people. But I had been reading Jesse's work for a while. And then so we corresponded over the course of several months. And then, yeah, the first time we met in person was in New York. We met right before the Heterodox conference. We like had food and beer or something. But you saw us right at like one of our early conversations.
Right on. Legendary historical moment that I witnessed.
Yeah, exactly.
So you two are quickly making waves. Now, can you maybe just both of you just go one by one, just introduce yourself? I did a bio, but if you could just introduce, how would you like to be viewed as?
I'll let Katie go first because she's smarter than me.
I'm actually not smarter than Jesse, but I'm funnier than Jesse, which is worth more, it turns out. I think of myself as a media critic primarily. As you mentioned in the bio, I was a staff writer at The Stranger, Seattle's alt-weekly, until recently. I was laid off in the wave of COVID layoffs. And so now I'm doing some freelancing. I've written a couple pieces for The Guardian and The Atlantic since the layoff, but mostly what I am is a podcast co-host. That is now the most important part of my identity, now that people are actually giving us money to do this. But my interests are fairly aligned with Jesse's and probably with yours in some respects. I'm interested in psychology and human behavior, particularly why humans sometimes do such crazy things. Before this, I wrote a lot about climate change and the environment, but I find that parsing a human consciousness is more interesting to me now.
Cool. Jesse, how do you, what are some things that are core to your identity these days?
Man, that's a good question. I have one foot a little bit in academia because when I was 27-ish, I left a sort of permanent freelancer job at the Boston Globe where I'd been doing opinion writing. I went to public policy school and I learned more about psychology, economics, statistics, and it really turned me away from just straightforward, this is right, this is wrong opinion writing. I got much more interested in why people believe what they do. Led me to a lot of thinkers like Danny Kahneman, John Haidt, just this whole universe of a different way of looking at things where it's less, you don't believe in gay marriage, so I think you're bad, and more like, why did you come to some, such different conclusions about morality as I did? And I think there's a way to do that where you don't lose sight of your own beliefs, but you just understand how complicated the human brain is.
Yeah, for sure. And that's my introduction to you is your writing on the replication crisis, I believe at New York Magazine. I thought it was really well done, Jesse. So that's where I first encountered you. Now, why did you decide to start this podcast together, Blocked and Reported? Why did you decide to start it together?
You want to take that?
Yeah. It's such a weird time. And COVID makes the last, when we started in March, right?
Yeah. Oh, wait, did we? I think we started, I don't know. Time has ceased to have any meaning, but it might have even been April.
It might have been April. So Katie and I have had similar experiences where we run up against this thing where in liberal and lefty journalism, and we're both firmly on the left by any conceivable metric, certain subjects are very difficult to talk about. And when I say this, people caricature that position as though what I'm advocating is like phrenology or race science, when really, I think like what's going on now is a good example where there's a lot of complexity to the protests going on, to the question of how to reform the police. And I think a lot of people feel like they can't talk about this stuff openly. They can't weigh costs and benefits, what policies we should pursue, how race and class intersect. So that's the classic kind of single Herzog issue where we have, I think, traditionally gotten ourselves in trouble on Twitter for maybe speaking about it a bit too freely. Do you think that's fair to say, Katie?
I do, yeah. I think that Jesse and I tend to both be motivated by data and by empirical evidence and things that can be tested, and a little bit less by emotion. And that probably makes us like less fun to hang out with than most people, and maybe a little bit too like oh, let me explain to you how the world works using numbers. But it's not necessarily the sort of, I think, dominant personality trait among much of the media right now. And it puts us at odds with a lot of other people. And there seems to be a desire for that conversation. The response from to this podcast so far has been like sort of overwhelming. We're getting a lot of messages from people who say things like, thank you for making me feel less crazy. And so I feel like, that's kind of the goal for me, at least, is to, besides make enough money to get in the above ground pool to make people feel less crazy, because I feel crazy right now.
Yeah, I think I completely echo that goal of making people not feel crazy. I also think we want to carve out a space where, like, I don't think Katie or I want to give up our identities as progressives. And a lot of the people who get caught up in some of the craziness right now sort of change their political identity entirely because they feel so unwelcome, especially online. And I think that's unfortunate because, the question of who's meaner on Twitter, is the left meaner, is the right meaner, that shouldn't determine your politics. Your politics should come from core aspects of your identity and your values.
Says you.
Says me,
your opinion. Your opinion. So why do you think let's really zoom in on why your podcast has taken off by storm. You're at what now, 5,000 a month on Patreon?
5,800, Scott.
Okay.
Well, sorry. That was very snooty. I should be clear. Katie and I had no idea this was going to happen, and we're sort of in shock about it. But yes, we're at 5,813 as I look at this, less than a month in.
If we were in normal fields like tech or something, this would be like, this would be pennies. But as a journalist, this is like the equivalent of J.K. Rowling's money.
Oh, come on. And as a scientist, then it's, let's be realistic, as an academic. I really want to zoom in, though. Like, what do you think is the people that are signing up? What are they craving? What is the underlying basic human need that you're fulfilling from a Maslowian perspective?
So you want like actual which part on the pyramid of the hierarchy needs?
I think we're shelter.
Yeah, we are shelter
at this point. Your shelter. And then what's the storm that they're trying to come away from? The media?
Social media.
Social media. Yeah.
And, Katie, and right run with, now, no, Katie should run with this. This is good. We're shelter.
There's a, right now we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and I keep coming back to this one phrase, the pressure to conform. I think people are really experiencing that within, and especially because of the pandemic, and we're seeing people less in person unless you go to a protest. So much of our communication now is filtered through social media and online. And there's not a lot of room for nuance and debate, talking about difficult issues, as Jesse mentioned. And I think that what we're providing for people is just a way to listen to two people talk about these things that isn't driven by ideology, that isn't strident. I hope that we're not, I'm okay with us being know-it-alls, but I hope that we're not the sort of people who, I don't know, pressure others to conform to their opinion. So I think that's what it is. I think people feel like genuinely nuts right now, and they don't know how to talk to their friends about it because they're scared if they do, they'll get excommunicated. And so they listen to our podcast instead.
And we should say, like, this isn't some idle concern. Like, just today, a 28-year-old data science guy at Civis Analytics, which is a big data and polling firm in DC, all he did was tweet that there's some political science from this African-American studies professor at Princeton suggesting that violent protesting and rioting leads to a political backlash. That's a very important finding. He got fired, capital F fired, just for tweeting that. I think this is an outlying case, but when people send us messages, this is increasingly the sort of thing they're concerned about, that if I tweet the wrong thing or say the wrong thing, there's going to be disproportionate consequences.
Yeah, I hear you. And Katie, you said something that really stuck out at me on Twitter the other day, and we'll be going through a lot more of your tweets in a second.
But, uh-oh.
But one that you said that really stuck out at me is you're like, I've never felt more free in my entire life. And look, that really hit home for me as well. What do you view as freedom then?
For me, it really comes down to not having bosses. So right now, I mean, if I were trying to make it as a freelancer right now, a freelance writer, or if I were trying to get a staff job, I would be really constrained in what I can say. And this is not, like, my views are very normative. I'm sort of a regular, milquetoast liberal. I'm a registered Democrat. I don't think I believe anything, you know, outside the Overton window at all. But when you work at a media job, at a staff media job, particularly right now, there's an attitude that everybody who doesn't conform to the same narrative is wrong. And if you're wrong, you are bad. And if you are bad, you are evil. And there's a real cost to that because people feel afraid to say what they want to say, you know, and people are getting fired. There was that analyst that Jesse mentioned. There's been lots of cases of this, particularly people in academia, which, you know, you would think they would be more protected, and in media. Now that Jesse and I are creating this business where we're not, my ability to say what I want isn't constrained by the fear that my coworkers, besides Jesse, are going to get mad at me. I just don't have to worry about it. I mean, so much of my sort of internal brain space and stress, but what I had a job at The Stranger was trying to figure out what I could say and what I could say in a way that wasn't going to get me either a talking to or my boss wasn't, I didn't want other people to sort of have to, you know, pay for my sins. So my bosses would get emails. I didn't want that to happen. And I just don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, I'm sure that there's something I could say that would probably make our Patreon followers leave, or Jesse could, or maybe when Jesse writes his rap for his rap about the replication crisis, which was one of our stretch goals.
I think you should both start taking pictures of what you're doing with people's money.
Oh, God.
Instagram different pictures of look, we're on a jet.
That might be the thing that would make everybody stop giving us their money.
That's what I'm thinking.
But unfortunately, I don't think $6,000 a month will get us there yet. So that's what I mean by free. I don't right now, especially in the media, if you say the wrong thing, if you believe the wrong thing, if you say that you don't think Woody Allen's book should have been pulped by his publisher or whatever, there's a real danger to that. And I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah, I can see why you would feel free.
But this is also I'm in a very unique position because and one of the reasons we're in this unique position is because Jesse and I do have this sort of freedom in some ways. and other people don't. And so we can say the things that they can't say.
So you're saying you're privileged?
Yes, I am. I'm saying
we're absolutely privileged.
We have a, independent podcast wealth privilege. So that's what I mean. It's not, I also haven't left my house in 3 months. So it's a weird sort of freedom.
Me neither.
So, but at the same time that freedom is being restricted for everybody around us, we have this newfound ability to support ourselves by saying what we want.
Yeah. And so it sounds like this dynamic that you describe, the stranger, is going on at the New York Times right now, right?
Yeah. I think it's going on everywhere.
Absolutely. And what pisses me off about this is there's a subset of journalists who will go on Twitter and loudly claim A, that it's not happening, B, anyone who claims it's happening has a suspect political agenda and is just, wants to be a Ben Shapiro fan or a far right person. Katie and I both get tons of emails from people in journalism and academia. That's safe to say, right, Katie?
Oh, yeah.
And they send us those emails because they know we're going to be sympathetic. Why would you send an email about your workplace situation to someone you think might, screen cap that and make fun of you on Twitter? So I think people who are sure this stuff isn't going on should consider there might be a reason you're not hearing from the people affected by it.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it hadn't even really occurred to me. So what happened is at the New York Times, for your listeners who don't know, so the New York Times published an op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton that essentially argued for sending the national troops into the U.S. cities and states to quell the civic unrest or civil unrest. And then there was a huge amount of pushback from the staff. And then Barry Weiss, who's a staffer there, basically wrote a series of tweets saying that there's a civil war inside the New York Times. And the response to that was a bunch of her colleagues saying that this doesn't exist. And it hadn't even occurred to me until Jesse and I had this conversation that some people in the New York Times probably weren't lying. They really didn't or aren't even aware that this thing exists because the only message that they're getting is the one they already believe. It's just, we're all surrounded by confirmation bias, which is, it's just sort of remarkable to me. You really don't even realize. It's very strange.
Well, what do you guys do to try to get outside of your own bubble on your podcast?
I think it's been easier as I've developed. So I think the average, reader of my articles and my chunk of our fan, the chunk of our fans who came in via me versus via Katie, is definitely left of center. They're sort of like Obama liberals, but there's also been a subset of sort of genuinely centrist and right of center people. I would imagine the percentage of our listeners who are Trump fans is very, very small, but I've interacted with a slightly wider array of people than I would have, say, when I worked at New York Magazine in 2016. Just hearing other voices and hearing their critiques of liberal ideas and lefty ideas, I think is important just as sort of to exercise your intellectual muscles and your skepticism muscles. So for me, that's been a big part of it. And also just, I'm curious if Katie feels the same way, but there's a subset of issues where in the course of being a reporter, I've learned a great deal about them. And then I've seen how they're covered in other more ideologically conformist outlets. And that has shown me that I need to be skeptical because I see stuff printed on the screen that I know is not true. And it's been a little bit of a, can we swear on this podcast or no?
Sure. I'll have the market explicit though.
No. Okay. I don't want to drag you over that threshold. It's been a mind bleep. It's been a mind bleep to honestly get into these specific nitty gritty areas and then see how these controversies are covered by Vox or BuzzFeed or the New York Times. It has to make you a little bit more skeptical just as a living, breathing, thinking adult.
Yeah, it's a discomforting experience in a lot of ways to when you become familiar with an issue and you see media outlets reporting falsehoods, repeating misinformation. It's outlets that you trust. It's destabilizing in a lot of ways, and I don't mean that in sort of a Donald Trump fake news way, but just so much is just colored by ideology and bias that when you see that, it becomes difficult to unsee it. And in terms of getting out of the bubble, I talked to conservatives. And this is something I didn't do before 2016. But after Donald Trump was elected, I had a feeling that Trump was going to be elected. I predicted it about 6 months before. And after he was elected, the shock by everybody around me. I lived in Seattle at the time, and you know, we're in these sort of hyper-liberal media circles, and just the utter shock by everybody around me. Most people who didn't know a single Trump supporter and who were proud of that fact just really showed me that if the media wants to reflect what's happening in the world, we have to talk to people we disagree with. And it's such a, like, that shouldn't be a revelation, right? It should not be a shock that you need to speak to people who believe things that you don't believe. But I went out of my way to start doing it. And now I wouldn't say that I have like great friends who are conservatives, but actually maybe I do. You know, I have like, I hang out with like some libertarians now. Before all of this stuff happened, I thought libertarians were just insane. I thought they were crazy. And now I find that I agree with a lot of their positions, and not entirely because my politics have evolved, but it just turns out like there's a lot of civil rights issues or civil liberties issues that I, you know, believe in the libertarian position, which is often also the liberal position or used to be. So I try now not to judge people as much on who they voted for. You know, it's just, I don't think who we vote is necessarily a reflection of our worth as a person. And I enjoy talking to conservatives. I find it oftentimes easier to talk to conservatives because there isn't this sort of pressure to agree. You know, we don't have to deal with the narcissism of small differences. And it doesn't become as heated. I know that I'm not going to be on the same ideological page as somebody who's actually very conservative. And so we leave the conversation not feeling sort of angry about it. So I think I've learned a lot more about the world and about how people work since I've started talking to people who don't necessarily agree with me all the time.
Can I add one quick thing to that? We've said some stuff on the podcast, obviously, that listeners disagree with. And, you know, I did a long interview with this leftist thinker, Ben Burgess, I really like. Some people disagreed with aspects of it. The difference that I've noticed lately, and there's some selection bias at work here, in the way liberals and conservatives express disagreement. And again, I want to kick it to Katie after this to see if she agrees. A lot of people on the left seem incapable of just disagreeing without also couching it as some sort of sign of
morality.
Yes, moral degradation on the part of the person they disagree with. Conservatives will say, you know, I disagreed with this, here's why, and they leave it at that. They don't, obviously, if you go online, you'll find people who will call you like an SJW cuck or whatever, but the conservatives I've interacted with are weirdly more capable of just disagreeing and acknowledging disagreement than people on the left, which I find very frustrating because I think that's an important skill to build.
Yeah, well, people on the left would counter, or those people you're referring to on the left would probably counter, that's because they have morals.
Right. Yeah.
So if you don't even know what it means to feel like to get outraged by things because you don't care, then of course you can talk about it more calmly. But now I'm not saying that's my position. I'm saying I could see see a devil's advocate. I think that this increasing communication and increasing the communication, the synchronicity of the communication style is really important. So regardless of what direction is what, if you have people who are really angry and coming from a place of rage, anger, and the way the state of the world is, and you've and others trying to communicate with you through more of a different, you know, modality of human existence, it's just going to be talking past each other, right? So I wonder how we can do that without telling people, you know, the more you tell people just calm down, the more. Have you ever tried that, Jesse? Telling an angry person just calm down?
I think I have an answer to that, which is if someone comes at me on Twitter and they're very mad at me, I will ask them to explain to me exactly what it is I've said that they disagree and why they disagree with it. And often they're unable to do that. They're just mad at me, but they don't know why. So I don't think saying them to calm down is the right answer. I do think if you're mad enough at me to come at me on Twitter, I have a right to say, what is it you disagree with? Tell me exactly. And if they can't answer that, they're not worth engaging with.
Yeah, I think I like Jesse's tactic. I don't know that it changes people's... Actually, it probably changes the minds of the observers. I think it could have some utility with that. I wonder if it works as well with the people who've already decided that you're trash. And this is something that I feel like I'm struggling with right now is, how do I talk to people about these things who don't know that they're happening, all of the sort of the cultural revolution, sort of moral panic that I think we're in the midst of right now? A lot of people don't see it. And I want them to see it because I think it's dangerous. And I don't know. I mean, other than like going to their house and, you know, blasting the podcast outside their windows until they listen, I don't know how to convince people to just be a little bit open to this idea that something's happening. I was hoping you could answer that for me, Scott. You're the psychologist.
Open to what happening in particular?
Open to seeing that something is going on that they might not be aware of.
Oh, it's something just, outside of their own perspective.
Something outside of their own perspective, right? I think there's such a people, especially on the left right now, are so convinced of their sort of moral righteousness that if I say something like maybe people shouldn't be fired for, you know, having like worn a stereotypically Puerto Rican costume when they were, you know, in college or whatever. How do I make people see this?
Well, this is interesting. If people you're describing on the left are morally righteous, would you say there's an equivalent on the right of maybe not moral righteousness, but truth righteousness? Like they think they have the answer. Is there a different kind of righteousness on the right?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, think about Christianity. I think Christians probably tend to be more conservative. I think they're utterly convinced of their, you know, righteousness. And I also don't think there's anything I could do to, you know, I can't convince someone who believes that the world was made in 6 days and that gay people are going to hell that the world wasn't made in 6 days and there is no hell. And I think there's, you know, the commonality there is that it tends to be very religious in both cases. I don't think I can talk someone out of their belief.
To be clear, I think Katie's going to hell, but for reasons completely unconnected from her sexuality.
That's
an important point, I think, because like, I went through years of like, to the extent people got mad at me, it was people on the right. Like I went through years of that, which might not be visible to people now, but there's a subset of people on the right I don't necessarily think it's worth engaging with. If they wanted to have a good faith conversation, I would. But part of the reason some of my focus has been on the left is I think there's trends here that could hurt the left in the long run. And I feel like this is more sort of my extended family. But all these dynamics, again, you know, you're a social, you know this, Scott, like these are human dynamics. And I've had conservatives explain to me that whatever sociopathy you see on Twitter, you could find that in like small town churches, where if you say the wrong thing at a luncheon, you're ostracized from the group forever. This is just, we're all just primates concerned about status and in-groups and out-groups. It's the same thing wherever you look.
Yeah, I think the reason in part that we think this is so much more prominent on the left is because we're on the left. This is where we see it. This is also a reflection of our own echo chambers. But I'm sure if you go to some like, you know, small town church Facebook group, there's drama and infighting and, you know, people say the wrong thing and get kicked out.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, a lot of it is ego. Ego's being threatened and you're seeing group egos being threatened. So if you're strongly identify with something and your group is not being respected, then that becomes the most important issue to you out of any other issue in the world. And then it gets really problematic if you really want to talk about how messy humans are. If you zoom out a second and realize, oh my gosh, every group's the same way. See, the fact is every group thinks they're the only ones that are the victims.
That's called the bias. It's like the bias, right? We think everyone else is biased, but we're the rational actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, everyone else is biased and we are the rational actors.
Right, I was going to say Blocked and Reported happens to be the only podcast free of any bias on the planet. So I don't want to detract from that message.
Yeah.
Okay, you might have pulled the hat trick there. But the thing is, I would like to have empathy and compassion for everyone. So I would like to, I think the ultimate state to be in is one where we try to listen to everyone's viewpoint, and it doesn't mean that we agree with it, but we try to have a dialogue where everyone acknowledges everyone else's viewpoint. But of course that, you know, that kumbaya gets tricky when we talk about people who think in terms of zero sum games. And that's what the world is at right now, is zero sum thinking.
But can I use your platform, which despite your kind words, your platform is much larger than ours. And I just want to make a quick point about, think about it this way. There is a guy who didn't graduate high school in Ohio or Kentucky in an area ravaged by the opioid crisis. He has a lot to fear from the police. The police do no-knock raids. They use weapons in an irresponsible way. They do civil forfeiture where they can just take your car on the thinnest of premises. All this stuff happens in poor white communities. I'm not saying it happens as much statistically or whatever, The point is, if you care about politics, there's a message you could say to that guy in Kentucky or Ohio that would raise him out of the tribalism, that would make him think he has something at stake in the battle for police reform. If you have that opportunity, why would you instead tell him the opposite, which is that as an evil conservative Trump voter, he has no part to play in that movement? That's where the question of sort of civility and political efficacy intersect, as far as I'm concerned, because a lot of the messaging going on right now, it's just designed to sort of rev up the people who are already converted, not to sort of increase the number of people on board.
Well, you've entered tricky territory, my friend. But I will say I am working on an article right now trying to get at the root of some of this. And what I think you see a lot of is, you know, having the victimhood mindset actually gives you a power play over others. It lets you get resources. It lets you have immunity from immorality and like retaliation. Like if you retaliate with violence, well, you're the victim, so that's fine. You'll get empathy for it. So there's a whole set of things that come along if you can have a victimhood mentality. Now, I'm sure not saying whether it's justified or not. I'm not making a blanket statement and saying everyone who acts like they're a victim is just trying to get a power play. I want to be clear, I'm not saying that. And everyone knows having a superordinate goal is the only way to bring together humanity. Like psychologists know that.
It's a contact hypothesis, which everyone is ignoring, even though it's like a really important idea.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you, Scott. But
I was on a roll, Jesse.
Sorry. No, I know the reason I rudely talked over you is this really gets my goat. Is like the best evidence for bringing people of different groups together, and it's like all psychological evidence, it's context dependent, it's complicated, is the contact hypothesis. That's it. That is, if you have people of different groups and you can put them in a situation where they have a shared goal and have equal status to the extent possible, you can get beyond these group boundaries. You can have them, you know, feel like they're part of a superordinate group or have a superordinate goal. And a lot of the discourse I see on some of the most important issues in the country seems much more geared at dividing people up than you know, conceiving of a way to bring them together. You're the expert. Did I just describe the contact hypothesis clearly?
Yeah, totally. You're right. And that's what I meant by, you know, the superordinate goal, having that a humanity, you know, something that rallies us all together as human first, as opposed to identity or group first. It is tricky because it seems like politics now has become a tool for winning as opposed to policy. Does anyone remember the days when like policy was supposed to be thoughtfully used as a way to help humans, you know, as a species, you know? Now it's become a dividing tool. What do you think of my thoughts on the victimhood mindset and how sometimes you can kind of get stuck in this trap where you actually don't want to get out of it?
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you can observe this every day on social media for sure. I saw a paper that was floating around this week that I didn't read that from the dialogue, it seemed the paper seemed to be saying that victimhood is a stable personality trait.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I'm writing up right now. Yeah, I've been in touch with those authors about trying to connect that to collective victimhood, which is another construct. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a little more torn on it because I absolutely agree this dynamic goes on. And well, especially in light of this idea that victimhood brings status, we should emphasize that Katie and I have been victimized more than anybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Huge victims.
That said, I'm always torn on this because like in a country that really was built on staggering unfairness, I want to hear, you know, if someone says they're a victim, there's often merit to that claim. So it's like you can go too far in either direction. You can say, as soon as someone says they're a victim, they are a victim, they should be treated as a victim. Or you can sort of adopt the victimhood mentality as your overall model for explaining the world and suggest that any claim of victimhood is unfounded and shouldn't be taken seriously. So I just think there's maybe a Aristotelian middle ground somewhere in there.
There is. I mean, the ultimate would be for all humans to come together and say, we're all victims of discrimination. We want to work together to fight discrimination. That's one way. That's one model.
Yeah, no. I definitely get what you're saying.
I wonder how much of this is conscious on the part of the people engaged in it. I do think this sort of, you know, maybe victimhood is just a meme. Maybe this is just another thing like floating through culture. I mean, I'm serious. It's just, I don't think that I can't imagine that like our grandfather's generation sort of got, you know, sort of social status from victimhood. You know, I think masculinity and power and other things were the, you know, the status getters at that point.
This is the Jason Manning, Bradley Campbell theory, right? Victimhood, the idea that we have this whole new system that valorizes victimhood, which I was very skeptical of when they wrote that book, which I haven't read, but I'm at least on Twitter, it is absolutely yeah. the case that if you claim
something I didn't read.
Yeah, exactly. That's what journalists do.
Sorry to interrupt you, Jesse, but there's like, I was doing a radio interview yesterday with a conservative talk radio guy out here in Seattle. And I said something about, I'm not really sure what the context is, but I said something about how, about privilege. And he said, well, you're not privileged because you're gay, and he's gay too. And I didn't sort of push back on that because the conversation just moved on. But there is that narrative that because of these particular demographics and historical oppression that I, you know, a lesbian in 2020 should feel oppressed. And I absolutely do not feel oppressed in any particular way. But there is this sort of assumption, like if you check any sort of minority status, you are automatically a victim, even if you're, you know, even if you're wealthy, even if you're educated, even if you're gorgeous. You know, Chrissy Teigen was sort of... recently, the cookbook writer Alison Roman criticized Chrissy Teigen, and Chrissy Teigen was portrayed as a victim of racism in that, even though, you know, she's one of the most successful women in the world. It's strange. It's so strange.
You know, you don't have to have a victim mentality, even if you've been a victim.
Like, right. That's also the question. Does feeling like a victim help people? And you guys know way more about the data than I do. But I mean, if you just, you know, think about John Haidt's work, I mean, it seems like resilience, what we should want as individuals and as a culture is resilience and the ability to get past adversity, not wallow in it, just for our own mental health. I mean, I don't think feeling like a victim necessarily makes people happier.
It's a very interesting question that I know people like Coleman Hughes and Jonathan McWhorter have been trying to really grapple with, is from an African-American perspective, when will there be a point where, you know, is it reparations? Is it a collective sort of cultural apology? It is clear that we're not there yet. Like, there still needs to be something in order for African-Americans to feel safe in our country, to feel like they're part of the they're part of it. You know, they're part of American culture, and they're cared for. It seems like we're not there yet.
Yeah. No, and you can also understand. I mean, we're just now pulling down Confederate statues. Like, can you imagine? Sorry, this is just one of those issues where I'm absolutely in line with the so-called social justice warriors. But like, if you were in a country and they I can absolutely understand why they might feel that way. I just wanted to throw it. Like, I think this stuff is complicated, and Black public opinion is incredibly complicated, but I get it.
Yeah. I mean, I try to listen to perspectives and not claim I definitely know what I'm talking about. And I also opened to the fact that, you know, being born Black gives you a different experience in America, just like being born with a learning disability. I had a kid gave me a different experience as well. You know, we all have these different experiences, then we should listen to each other's stories. But no one's really listening to each other's stories right now, are they? I just feel like they're just willing to rip their heads off. Everyone's
no, not at all. It's sad.
Yeah.
So are you ready for me to start going through some of your tweets?
Oh, God. I brought a beer for this very question, so I'd be a little, but yeah, go for it.
Okay, I'm going to start with Katie. Just discuss. Quote, I realize this is obnoxious, but God, I love being right.
Okay, that was in response. You got to read the tweet above that.
Oh, I didn't realize it was in response to something.
Oh, yeah.
Were you right about something?
Too. Oh, sorry. So here's what happened. So I think that if the public health experts are to be believed, and I am still inclined to believe what they were saying a month ago or 2 months ago about the dangers of being out in giant crowds of people, particularly when people are shouting, during a pandemic, that it is a bad idea to attend these protests. Particularly, I was sort of particularly appalled because my wife, who's a nurse, her union. So, you know, we crashed the economy, stayed home for 3 months in part to help healthcare workers. And my wife's union sent her a text message urging her to go to a protest. And I've been having a hard time sort of articulating this because if you say that you don't think people should go to protests during a pandemic, what people read, what people hear is, I don't support the movement, which in my case is not true. I'm just deeply concerned about the spike in COVID cases that we may or may not see. I hope that we don't. And then if we see a spike in COVID cases, going back under lockdown, crashing the economy again, people losing their businesses. I lost my job. All like businesses in my neighborhood have started to close. It's really bad. And I want that. I think it, obviously I'm concerned about racism. I think the murder of George Floyd was terrible. I'm concerned about police brutality for when it comes to Black people and all other races. We need reform. That said, we're still in the middle of a bleeping pandemic. And it's the collective sort of amnesia here, where the same people who a week ago were sort of making fun of quarantine protesters are saying, no, this is fine now. My cause is just, and therefore it's okay to leave your house and be in a crowd of 10,000 people all screaming at the same time. And I've been really struggling with the hypocrisy and the cognitive dissonance over the past couple of weeks. And I'm seeing this not just online, I'm seeing it like in my actual social networks. It's been difficult to watch. And then I saw an opening. So the Black Lives Matter Seattle chapter issued a statement saying that they were discouraging their members from going to the protest because, as we have been hearing, these, you know, COVID is disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities, and going to a mass protest, if the public health experts were right, you know, the first time around before they changed their tune, is going to kill more Black and brown people. And so I felt totally virtuous and correct that I had been, you know, the one saying like, don't go to these protests if you still care about saving grandma's life and still care about frontline workers. I mean, it's one thing if you want to take on that risk to yourself, but it's not, if it was only taking on the risk to yourself, if the biggest danger was tear gas or rubber bullets or being shot by the police, I would say go. But because, you know, this disease is contagious, it's not just taking on responsibility for yourself. It's like potentially spreading this pandemic. So when Black Lives Matter, because we live in a time when identity is everything, when Black Lives Matter released a statement saying like, we're discouraging people from attending these protests and here's why, I felt totally validated. Yeah. Validated. It felt like, I am right. And then I made the mistake of posting a screenshot of the Black Lives Matter statement on Instagram, and just got text messages. I got from friends saying that I was racist. That's in part why Jesse and I are doing this podcast, because if I say I don't think people should be going out during a pandemic to like into gatherings with thousands of people, what people hear is, you don't care about the murder of George Floyd. You don't care about.
But people didn't call you racist when you retweeted Black Lives Matter saying it.
No, they did. They did.
They still called you racist, but yes. Would they call them racist?
Right. I was trying. No. Because I was basically, I was like, which was true. I was like using identity politics to try to make a point and say, you're not going to listen to me. Maybe you'll listen to Black Lives Matter. And these people said, no, you're using them, you know, you're using them, which is, you know, sort of valid criticism. I was waiting for an opening for basically, you know, a Black person to say, this is dumb. What are you guys doing? But that was the response to saying like, I don't think you should go out in a pandemic. So anyway, that's why I said, I love being right. Because in that case, I felt like I just validated my position. And I love being right. It is obnoxious, but I love it. I really do.
A lot of people love being right. Maybe that's what's wrong with America right now.
Yeah, I also, I will say it though, I also really like changing my mind. You know, I change my mind all the time. When I was working at The Stranger, I would interview political candidates and I would always ask them, what's something you've changed your mind on about lately? And I would say, you know, if you need to think, this is a difficult question. So if you need to think about it for a while, you can give me a call or email me. And the number of people who were completely unable to say that they had changed their mind about anything in like recent history was truly astounding.
Good. I'm glad that you're open to changing your mind. So let me bring up another tweet you wrote. It says, I spend half my day wondering if I'm outside the cult looking at the cult or if I'm actually in the cult and just can't see it.
Yeah. That's how I feel. I do. I really do. I think that I suspect that we have entered a moment of moral panic and sort of mass hysteria. That seems to be one thing, but might really have some other underlying things going on. And, you know, when your social networks, especially online, are filled with people saying the exact same thing it starts to feel like you're watching a cult. You know, and I feel this way in other ways. Like, over the past 6 years, it seems like everybody I know got into astrology. You know, it's like they all found Jesus overnight. It's a very sort of destabilizing experience to say, like, I thought that, you know, I assume that the people that I know are sort of rational thinkers. And all of a sudden they're talking about how, like, you know, the reason I don't believe in astrology is because I'm a Taurus and stuff like that. But I identify as a Gemini.
Wait, that's interesting. I usually say I am a Gemini because I was born June 3rd, but I can redefine that now.
Well, I mean, I am a Taurus, but I identify as a Gemini.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I have never heard.
We are not getting into trans astrologism.
Wait,
right
I've
now.
Never heard that possible.
I mean, wait, it is possible.
Wait, is that
I
a thing?
It.
People identify with a different sign? Wait,
I do.
You just blew my mind.
This is something I do to, like, make fun of two different groups of people at the same time. Don't adopt this. It's an obnoxious, like, when somebody asks me my sign, I literally say I'm a Taurus, but I identify as a Gemini. And then they typically stop talking to me.
Holy. Wait, that opens up a big can of worms.
You
with
can
the...
do whatever you want, Scott.
Wait, so with identity, so with trans identity, but with identity more generally, I can adopt... So I can be, so if my, I actually feel like I'm a MMA fighter.
Yeah, you feel like Joe Rogan.
I feel like I could just, so strong, you know, that if someone messed with me, you know, but I don't know, like, can that be my identity?
Well, sure. I mean, there was a guy who, do you remember this, Jesse? There was a guy somewhere in Europe who tried to, like, change his birth certificate to being, like, he was, like, a man in his 60s or 70s and tried to, like, legally change his age.
Oh, yeah,
because
I saw
he identified
that.
As a 30-year-old.
I saw that.
I think the court ruled, or whatever organization, I think he was ruled against. So, sorry, Scott.
I have no comment on any of the last 4 minutes of conversation.
Okay, but why? Do you really don't have a comment, or you're trying to stay out of it?
No, I'm not really trying to stay out of it. I just have complicated views on a lot of stuff. And I don't think Katie disagrees with me on this at all, but I think the vast majority of the time when someone says I identify as X rather than Y, it is a good faith statement of, like, something they believe strongly. And I think we should generally almost always respect that. There's also, I think, as Katie is pointing to, a sort of weirder Tumblr subset of identity talk that we've actually talked about it. We had an episode on so-called online validity discourse, or the idea that it's so important to validate people, whatever they say. So I don't know. I don't want to give people the impression, at least in my case, and I think Katie's too, like, I think as a general rule, you should respect people's claims about their identity, but we should obviously look at it with a critical eye, because it isn't, if I feel a certain way about myself, it isn't inherently or automatically or on its face everyone else's job to sort of rearrange their own view of me around that, if that makes sense.
Well, I think that with this kind of topic, you need to talk about specifically what you're referring to. So I'm of a belief that someone tells me they're a gender identity, that's great. Like, I abide by it and I treat them as they want to be treated. But we were just making an absurd example. I mean, do you have any limits at all on this, you know, in the sense of what I remember, you know, well, there was a white woman who said her gender identity was black and she got in significant trouble for, so clearly within those rules, so even within the progressive world, there are limits to that. Like, you can't, you know, you can certainly be a man and say, my gender identity is a woman, but it doesn't seem okay to anything goes. You can't be a white person saying my identity, you know, my race identity is black, right?
I find that interesting, but yes, I think socially you're totally correct. You can say one and not the other. I think the interesting thing about that is I think there you can make a better argument for race being a social construct than sex being a social construct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we're talking about, like, actual sex, like biological sex, for
right,
sure.
Right.
It's just, well, it's, but this is like the discourse advances so fast. 5 years ago, being trans meant that your gender identity differed from your biological sex. Now I believe the mainstream position is that your gender identity is your biological sex.
Right.
So the definitions of these concepts are changing. And this is an example of where we weighed in on some nitty gritty radical linguistic issue. And that's taken as evidence that we're sort of not down for the broader cause, which is not true.
Right. Jesse and I both support the ability of adults to get whatever sort of treatment that is going to make them feel better about their lives.
I support the, I think kids, as long as they're comprehensively evaluated, that's the thing. That's what's annoying about Twitter is my views on this, I think, are to the left of like 90% of Americans. I really think like if teenagers are properly diagnosed with gender dysphoria and the process occurs in a careful, scientifically based way, I'm honestly okay with like 14 and 15 year olds going on hormones. I think sometimes that's the right choice. I just think this stuff gets so oversimplified when the question is, do you validate or not validate, full stop, someone's identity? Like it's a binary choice, as though anyone's identity can be snuffed out of existence or validated full stop just by someone said. It's a very online way of understanding the world. Cause I think all three of us probably have understandings of our identity that are a bit more stable and wouldn't snuff out of existence if someone else denied it.
Well, the horoscope example, that's why I zoomed in on that when Katie did that, because blew my mind. It's a fascinating, great starter topic to start to talk about this conversation and try to talk about, well, what are the domains in which it's laughable? Like, it felt laughable to me. So I'm sorry if I offended you at all by saying
you did not offend me. It was a joke.
That specific example seemed laughable to me. By no stretch of imagination is it laughable to me when someone tells me they're trans. I respect it and I believe in trans rights, you know. But that example you gave me, I mean, I never heard anyone say that before. So is that the point? Maybe it's because I hadn't heard it before. Like you could see a point where you have a whole bunch of activists start to say, no, like Gemini identity people matter. You know?
I can absolutely see that happening just because of the way the course of the culture is going, is moving at such a rapid clip. A lot of this stuff originates in queer circles, which is where, like, historically I have sort of existed in the world. So a lot of this stuff, I feel like I saw it years before it became sort of mainstream. So none of this seems weird. I mean, I know someone who actually identifies as a panda, you know, and I think that's ridiculous. I think it's really silly. But this person like takes this identity seriously. I don't know if this person like eats bamboo or whatever, but their gender is panda.
But also people haven't done like, I think sufficient. I wish people would look at this more sociologically or anthropologically. Like if a kid on Tumblr says, I identify as a panda, that is not usually a literal statement of how they feel. It's a confrontational, how are people going to respond? Can I stir up some shit? I'm sure there's some people who identify as a panda. It would be kind of fun to identify as a panda because I could just sit around all day.
I see what you're saying, Jesse. You're saying, well, you're like, hold up. There is, some people are making a case that there are biological, even in the brain, matching people's gender identity. There's some biological basis that doesn't determine, but may help explain why you may feel like you're a different identity, even that's opposite of your genitalia, for instance. But when pandas, there's no good scientific evidence that has been found, to my knowledge. No one's done the study showing that, no, actually certain brain activation patterns resemble something where that make it likely for you to feel like a panda rather than a human.
That would be awesome.
That's
what you're
really
saying,
nice.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm saying that, but I'm also just making an art because I think the arguments I'm making also apply to some people. Like teenagers on Tumblr exploring their identity, they're teenagers. And there's certain incentives online to be the guy who comes out as a new gender. There's also incentives to be the conservative who jumps into the conversation and yells at him. You could have a fight between two people where neither of them actually believe the opinion they're broadcasting. So I think understanding this stuff is a little bit behind the times. Online gets very weird, is all I would say. And Katie and I have both like waded our way into bizarre online communities. So you can't take stuff people say in charged online communities at face value. And it's often just as much about sociology and social status as their true innermost feelings.
Right. This is also outliers. I mean, there are a lot of people who like identify as, you know, the furry thing. There are people who really deeply feel like whatever sort of character they're acting out. And, you know, a lot of this is, I think, wrapped up in fandom in some ways, you know, hobbies, essentially. People's identities are complex and wrapped up in all that stuff.
It does put a strain on all of the psychological training we've ever had. You know, if someone comes and is queerly delusional, and I'm trying to think of an example that won't get me in trouble, that is queerly delusional, that like everyone agrees is queerly delusional.
You know, like you have, okay, so here's an example. You know, you have these cases where somebody has like, to their very core, this person feels like they need to have a leg cut off. This person feels like an amputee. You know, I'm sure that these are rare, but, you know, this is a thing that exists. Some like strange disorder or whatever that makes you feel like you need to have your arm cut off. You know, I mean, if that person went to a surgeon and said, cut off my arm, the surgeon's not going to do this. I'm not arguing that this is the same thing as being trans, because dysphoria isn't always, but can be like well treated with hormones and other medical interventions. But you probably wouldn't find a surgeon willing to perform a surgery on somebody like that, even if it was going to relieve their distress.
I also think the conversation gets sort of, when you make the source of the conversation, do you think a person who identifies as a man is literally a man? You're sort of missing the point, because like I can say, I think this person should not be fired from their job, or that they should have access to hormones, or that they should have access to surgery for strong moral reasons that have nothing to do with sort of ontological claims about what they quote unquote really are. And I don't know what it means to really be a man other than in a biological sense. And no one has really laid that out. So I worry we get caught up on these online debates that don't actually at root have a lot to do with trans rights, because 20 years ago, a totally different model prevailed where people, the ask was, I want to be treated as a woman, not I am literally a woman. And I think people miss the point. Like, what we should care about is no one getting fired from their job for how they present themselves or dress or having access to medical care. And there's all these challenges that don't really hinge on metaphysical questions.
Yeah, I think Jesse's really right about that. And also, I think that most trans people would probably say the same thing. They're much more concerned about employment discrimination or housing discrimination or how people treat them to their face. And they are these sort of hyper online debates about language and what it really is to be a man or really is to be a woman. People just want to live their lives. We just see the worst of it. And we just see the most like active narcissistic brand of any sort of activism online.
I get emails from people who make these sweeping claims about quote unquote trans activism. What I always tell them is like the average trans activist is like trying to lobby state legislators to not have discriminatory laws. In any area, journalism, activism, science, whoever you see on Twitter or social media, that is not like the average person. It's very self-selecting. So I don't like people just say stuff on that front that I don't think is realistic and reflects the full range of trans opinion and trans activism, for what it's worth. Not to get on a soapbox, but it's important.
Jesse, you're our resident social justice warrior today.
No, seriously.
Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
He's a social justice warrior.
By the way, I don't use social justice warrior as a derogatory term. I'm not that kind of person, you know, who's on social media all day being like, oh, let's make fun of the social justice warriors.
I think Katie does. I don't. Katie uses
that. I don't use it that often, but I think it describes something that I don't have another word for.
Yeah, because whatever word you choose, you're not like, then woke came up and then right. People said you can't say woke. Right. You need some word for it.
It describes a phenomenon, and like I would love to have a better word, but whatever word that would be, eventually that word become problematic too.
What is the thing we're trying to define is basically it's illiberal social justice advocacy, right?
I define it as social media justice warrior. Someone someone who, you know, hyper online, a restrictive view, an extremist, a very like illiberal view, as Jesse said, a restrictive view of what can be talked about. I think to me the stereotypical SJW would prefer to shout somebody down or cancel them than sort of have a conversation and try to get to the heart of disagreement.
Oh, I have a lot more tweets to get through, but I won't get through them all. Don't worry. I won't have you guys here all day. Let me do one more with you, Katie, and then
sure.
A couple from Jesse.
Sure.
Yusa wrote, I suspect this country would greatly benefit if there were more liberals on police forces and more conservatives on campuses.
People hated this tweet. It was awesome.
I don't know why people were so appalled by this tweet. I mean, I think it would be like, I think ideological diversity is good in any context. I think it would be better if people just knew more people who are not like them. In part because you learn how the world works. And I also think that I'm going to stereotype here, but I think that liberals on a police force might moderate a police force, and not because conservatives are more likely to shoot people, but because if you have any ideological diversity, you're less likely to get extremism. And so that's the point, is just to have people around you who can check your ideas so that You don't have groupthink. You don't have this mentality where you must be right because you don't get any pushback. You're surrounded by people who think exactly like you. And I think that's true on campuses as well. So I was really like, it was sort of astounding to me that so many people thought that this like very sort of, I don't know, anodyne idea was somehow, I don't know, problematic.
Well, certainly the college campus thing is something that the kind of height crowd have been arguing for, is that they need more viewpoint diversity. Okay,
yeah,
Jesse.
I mean, I went to a small liberal arts school in Asheville, North Carolina, a state school, but a liberal arts school. And this is in the South, and I still don't think I knew any conservatives in my college. And you should not be able to get through college without meeting anybody who you know has a different political perspective than you.
Okay, Jesse goes, me, kick puppies, everyone. That's a horrible slogan. Why would you say that? Me, no, the point isn't to kick puppies. It's far more subtle than that. Read these 10 links explaining what the phrase really means. This will get you on my side, I'm sure.
And it was about a thing going on the left right now where people say that we should abolish the police. And then being sane, someone will respond to them, what do you mean? Obviously, we need police. And then most abolish police people will say, no, 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 no. When we say abolish the police, we mean this other thing. And then you read 500 pages and you realize they're not actually calling for the abolition of the police. There's a subset of radical people who really want to abolish the police and to my mind, haven't even started to explain what whatever follows would look like. But most of the time when people say abolish the police, they don't mean that. So this is an example of what I was talking about earlier, which if you're trying to get other people on your team, why would you adopt a slogan that is just going to turn people off from the start?
That was a clever way of doing it. It was a unique angle. Okay, it's insane to me that it's 2020 and we have done such a poor job informing people about how online outrage can be weaponized.
So since the George Floyd protests kicked off, Katie and I talked about this on our podcast, Blocked and Reported. We may have mentioned this podcast once or twice already, Blocked and Reported. Patreon.com/blockedandreported, blocked and reported, blocked and reported, blocked and reported.
Because you guys need more money.
We do need more money.
Unironically need more money.
Yeah, there's no amount of money that we need that we don't need.
This is a capitalist society, Scott.
Blocked and reported.
Okay, so basically people are spreading screenshots of teenagers who have supposedly said racist things. This one account in particular who has 500,000 people has just targeted teenagers. In some cases, these teenagers have actually said racist things when they were 14 or 15 or 16 on Instagram. I'm a liberal. I'm of the mind we should be forgiving and that someone's life should not be ruined by however they're captured at their worst moment. But even worse than that, people have realized they can just game the outrage dynamics. They can put a fake caption on someone's Instagram or Snapchat or whatever photo, put it online, and they know that because of outrage, people will carry that far and wide. So there was already one instance in which a totally innocent kid was dragged through the mud over a fake screenshot. So that's what I mean when I say it's 2020. We should understand that when people get outraged, their brains turn off. And this is if you're liberal, centrist, conservative, libertarian, whatever. When you are emotionally aroused and angry, your brain turns off. You are not as skeptical as you should be. So you should think twice before retweeting some random kid who comes into your timeline.
It also just consequently tends to happen when I have chocolate as well. Brain turns off.
I get mad when I don't have chocolate, but that's a different issue.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. You're addicted in a way?
It's actually more pizza. Pizza is the one thing that I can't go more than a day with without. It's sad.
How about this one? There is video of Herzog in a band she performed in her 20s that the world should probably have access to. Now, can we put this on the show notes?
Oh, you definitely do not. The video is... So, do you want to explain the tweet, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, Katie on one of our podcast episodes talked about her past career as a musician in the Asheville, North Carolina metro area, right?
No, this was actually not there. It was around Chapel Hill. But I think the tweet was referring to, if I recall correctly, one of our stretch goals. If we haven't mentioned, we have stretch goals, and if people give us more money, we will do things like Jesse will write a rap about the replication crisis. So I think it was in reference to that.
But, is he going to do it?
Well, he has to write the rap.
I have to. I could be imprisoned if I don't.
Yeah. Canceled. So I was in a band in my 20s. I'm not going to tell you the name of the band, but also you would have to bleep it because there's a curse word in the name. But my job in the band, I'm not musical, but I danced. I was basically a go-go dancer. So I would dance topless, wearing pasties and a horse head mask. And I danced around with a machine gun and would like just basically look like a complete like Burning Man fool.
So we'll put it in the show notes.
People are, yeah, people are people I meet now are really shocked to learn that I used to be fun, but I did.
You know,
those days are over.
People, same with me. If I can get personal for a second and into volley back and forth.
Please do.
Yeah.
I was a professional breakdancer. People don't know that about
me. No way.
In my 20s, I was really into, I would watch BET every day. I was like really into gangster rap, and I had a earring, a diamond.
You can be canceled for this, Scott. Watch out.
Yeah, that's appropriation.
I had a big diamond earring. Really? I mean, but this was, oh my gosh. Really?
I would love to see this. Can you still breakdance?
Should I not have mentioned that I actually had appreciation for Black culture? I mean, like, what?
Yeah, that's a fireable offense now.
I loved Black culture more than I liked white culture. Is honestly.
White culture is horrible. White culture is like mayonnaise and white. I mean,
I like white bread.
Come on. Yeah, that's because you're white. I'm Jewish. I'm not white.
You like rye? Oh no, you can't. That's the problem. You can't. I mean, look, we're in a moment now.
Well, I was like, you know, the Jewish breakdancer, and my name was Scott Dog, DAWG.
Dude, my friend Nate in high school was the same way. He was you're not that tall. Nate's very tall. He's tall like me. And he was in our suburban high school, there was like, yeah, there was a group of Asian and Black kids, and he was the token white breakdancer. It was awesome.
And there is video evidence.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do that anymore.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is if you release your video evidence, I'll release my video evidence.
I have video also of my one other rap performance from grad school. So maybe we could all team up on this. Yeah. Except I'm actually never releasing that.
Yeah. I'm going to have to decline this offer.
Okay.
It's not safe for the internet.
Not safe for the internet. Okay. But probably mine isn't either. I'm shirtless. Jesse.
I am too. That's funny. I am too.
Yeah, that is fun. That is funny.
Yeah.
Jesse, this seems a relevant tweet to follow up on what we were just discussing, which is our embarrassing aspect. So we should bring you in here. I want to apologize for the times in college multiple times, if I'm being honest with myself, when I went to parties as a nerdy Jewish guy who had no idea how to talk to girls, end quote. I now realize that was appropriation, which is wrong.
I mean, that's literally
snarky.
Just me.
Bit snarky.
It's a little snarky. It's not appropriation because that's literally who I am. I don't know how to talk to women or anybody. So yeah, that was honestly, I think when we want to be earnest online, we sometimes drape it in irony and snarkiness. So I'm not just going to tweet I was pathetic in college, but that was my way of tying my college patheticness into the current event of people getting canceled over college party photos.
It's all about ego, Scott, as you mentioned.
It seems so.
I had no ego in college. I thought I had like, I mean, I guess we can get real now. I had what feels now, in retrospect, like serious self-esteem right now.
Katie and I have been keeping it real for the past hour. Thanks for joining us.
Everything I've said was a lie. No, I think in retrospect, I had real self-esteem issues in college. And the idea that anyone's best 4 years of their lives are going to be 18 to 22 when we're like all just messed up, half-baked babies, I don't think that's true. Or it wasn't in my case.
I was cool in college. Those actually probably were the best years of my life. I was in a girls' fight club, had lots of friends. I don't know. I've really fallen since then. It's been on the downhill slide. But now I have a podcast. So
I wait till my fifth year to join a fraternity, and I pledged with all freshmen. And anyway, that's a whole other story.
Did you get in? Did they allow you into
the
front?
I got in. No, I did. Right. I was the DJ.
Affirmative action hire, the old guy.
No, and I was the DJ at the frat parties and was really into music and stuff. Okay, so you have too many good quotes, Jesse. I just can't stop. This one's so good too. I think having a sizable chunk of, there's a look of horror on Jesse's face. Like he doesn't know.
That's just what his face looks like.
He literally doesn't know where I'm going with this.
I have no short term memory.
I think having a sizable chunk of people live their lives on social media is deeply, deeply unhealthy. I think you mix that with any sort of cultural media or panic and it becomes very, and varies in capital letters, important to loudly, he misspelled the word loudly. Loudly broadcast you're on the right side or the tides can pull you under. Do you still stand by that, Jesse?
Yeah. I mean, what we're seeing now is we saw a horrible public event, George Floyd getting murdered by a cop, lead to this reckoning with a complicated history. And to the average person, especially in my view, sort of like white liberals who don't have a direct role in any of this and feel disconnected from it, and who are staying home because of the pandemic, people are like, what can I do? All I can do is tweet endlessly, Facebook post endlessly, and it's very important to show you're on the right side of it. And as Katie and I have been dissecting on our podcast, which, to remind you, is known as Blocked and Reported, patreon.com/blockedreported.
They need the money, guys. They need the money.
Oh my God, we need it. Journalism is so screwed. This has just led to really weird performative behavior, and that's the sort of thing we like to talk about.
Well, related to that, you're kind of a broken record on that theme, because here's another tweet. Half of Twitter right now is stuff that is not, in fact, about solving racism or fixing the world, but people trying to use the present conversation to rocket launch petty grievances onto the internet, and everyone's just lapping it up to show they're on the right side. Whoa, Jesse.
Speaking the truth.
Yeah, I'm
in the gauntlet.
So
the gauntlet.
Well, the example we talked about in our latest podcast is somewhat a journalist will post a DM exchange with an editor from years ago where they say they were wronged and that this proves it was a hostile environment. And people, without knowing any context, they just retweet it because they want to be the part of the struggle. And sometimes the struggle isn't really a struggle. It's just some interpersonal gripe. So I think as I've developed better sort of online hygiene, I've tried to not participate in those dynamics and just instead stand on the sidelines yelling at people and being snarky about it.
It's more fun anyway.
Definitely.
I wrote a tweet. I will not agree with that. I wrote a tweet saying being mean and snarky gives you a sense of self-satisfaction in the moment, but being kind gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction the next day. So
that's beautiful.
That's beautiful.
I'm not sure which behavior is more monetizable though.
Okay.
Which one of you has better feet pics? That would be the answer.
Oh boy. Feet pics?
Yeah.
Wait, between me and Scott?
Yeah, that's how you monetize.
Scott clearly takes care of, it's definitely Scott. He takes care of him. We got lunch a few months ago. He's better put together than me. Like, I'm wearing a button down shirt and athletic shorts. I was going to record this shirtless before I realized there was going to be video.
There's no way Scott
doesn't have nicer feet. So if you're a foot fetishist, send Scott an email directly. Scott, do you want to say your email address?
I'm just going to move right along. Right along from that comment to our Twitter comments. All sorts of people weighed in, in high anticipation for this conversation. Patrick Lockwood said, has Katie gone through my book yet?
I have. I have started Patrick's book. Hi, Patrick. So the reason I got Patrick's book, he wrote a book on fear, and I was planning on writing a book about fear. And then we started this podcast, and I realized I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to do anything. I can just be a podcaster.
You're free.
I am free.
Keith Humphrey's suggestion, how's the rap song about the replication crisis coming along there, Jesse?
Dope.
You know, you remind me so much of this...
Rob Schneider?
No, this TV series.
What? I just got you the explicit label. Bleep that up.
Have you watched this show on Hulu?
Dave.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. Great show.
You remind me of Dave, yes, Jesse.
Do I?
Because
do
you think
I
could skills? Go on...
Well, we'll see what happens
that
he
has sex with
a shaggy
dolls.
Jew.
Yeah.
What was the second one?
He has sex with sex dolls. that was a reference to Dave, not Jesse, just to be clear.
Yeah, I mean both.
There was one about your dad. Okay, so someone popped in and said, Jill C., I'll give them credit, Jill C. said, I would ask Katie how her growing up with her research psychologist, anthrozoologist dad, Herzog Hall is the Twitter name of your dad, in case you were wondering, influenced her journalism and view of human nature. And then your dad, responded, interesting question, ...
My dad's name is Hal Herzog, and he is on Twitter. I have more followers on him, just to want to make that note. So my dad is he is an anthrozoologist, or he's retired now, but he was a psychology professor whose specialty was human-animal interactions. So he wrote a book that's quite interesting, although I stopped reading it at the dedication. It's called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And it's about sort of the contradictions in humans' relationship with animals. Why are some things pets and some things lunch? He was sort of an ethnographic study as well of big animal people. And he has had a very immense impact on me. I think I have a twin sister, and I'd say she is my mom and I am my dad. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. He's a contrarian for sure. Actually, he wanted me to ask you a question, Jesse, about the replication crisis, about the French guy. Are you doing anything on the French guy?
Which French guy?
I don't know.
Wait, wasn't there a French sociologist who wrote about Staple? The Stanford prison experiment? Diedrich Staple is Dutch, not French.
No, I don't know what he's talking about. He said that you do, but apparently
also, Katie, this is going to be weird, but that account that you think is your dad is actually me.
That is really weird.
I just thought
really
I should confess
weird.
That.
That is really weird.
That's been sending a lot of weird
You guys
messages.
Have the oddest relationship.
Yeah. So he's a, my dad is, he's a, I don't want to identify myself as a contrarian because I don't feel like one. I think I just take the right position, and sometimes the right position is the one that's like that's contrary to the dominant position. But he is somebody who does the same thing, and he also so the particular field that he works in, he is somebody who has, I would say, pissed off a lot of people in that field. So I do probably get that from him.
Who are the journalists that you both most avidly read? That was a Roboros Anarchy. I love these Twitter names.
You want to go first, Jesse?
Yeah, I'm trying to think because like lately, I mean, there's like a bunch of New Yorker people who are just pros, like Elizabeth Colbert, Jeff Toobin on legal stuff. I'm trying to think. Jonathan Chait on sort of like quote unquote classical liberal issues or whatever you want to call it at New York Magazine. Eric Levitz at New York Magazine is a great young writer, just like with really solidly to the left liberal principles. This is a weird and petty thing to say, but there's so many writers lately who are just like really making me question their judgment on social media that I don't know, man. I've been very down on a lot of mainstream journalism lately. Those are a few examples. One book that had a big impact on me is James Forman Jr.'s Locking Up Our Own. It was a Pulitzer winner. It's about the complicated dynamics in high crime black communities. And it sort of, I think, especially to essentialize white people who want to better understand this stuff should knock themselves away from sort of racial essentialism. And he does a really good job of showing that the trade-offs that high crimes communities face, where they want tougher policing, they want to be protected by the cops, but the cops often abuse them at the same time. So he's more of an academic than a journalist. He's a former public defender, but I guess if I could just throw one recommendation, Locking Up Our Own by James Forman Jr.
I've been reading and listening to a lot of black heterodox thinkers lately. So John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry, Coleman Hughes, Camille Foster, Thomas Chatterton Williams. I find them fascinating and they say things that I've never thought about before. I'm also, Jesse and I both have are fans of Alice Drager, who wrote a book called Galileo's Middle Finger.
Everyone has to read that book.
This book is, when I see somebody get sort of dogpiled on Twitter, there's been maybe 12 times when I've reached out to them and I've sent them either Alice's book or John Ronson. So You've Been Publicly Shamed. John Ronson also, I love his work. I read Andrew Sullivan every week and I don't always agree with him, but I always appreciate his writing and perspective. Although I might get canceled for saying that. And then, you know, I read all sort of the big sort of mainstream ones, Khaled Hassani and The New Yorker. I love his work. Yeah, and then, you know, I read, like, the New York Times and Vox and all of those things. And I also try to read some conservative outlets just to keep some balance.
I'd like to just point out that Alice Drager, Coleman Hughes, and Bradley Campbell have all been prior guests of the Psychology Podcast.
Yeah.
Well, you are really going downhill in terms of your
guest
quality.
Yeah, seriously.
Why is that?
BlackNerdReported@gmail.com.
Yeah, BlackNerdReported.
Because I have you two on now?
No. Yeah. Yes, yeah. I'm joking, though.
So is there anything, any grievances you two want to air? Is there anything you want to say to your critics? Look, I'm going to tell you my own perception. I'm talking to you guys for an hour now and 25 minutes. You both seem to me like thinkers, but you also seem like compassionate humans. I don't get this. I know you started off saying, well, the thing that separates us is that we don't have emotions. Katie said something along those lines, but just talking to you and even, you know, bringing up some topics and see how sensitively you handle them, even just in this podcast, I would say you two have some goodness in you as well.
Don't
not just
ruin
thinking.
Our reputation, Scott.
I was going to say, off mic, Katie is deeply abusive and sexually harasses me. So that's just her
you
public
like it,
persona
Jesse.
Is totally different.
You like it.
I'm asking for it. Yeah, I came in shirtless. Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't mean to take your edge off. That certainly wasn't my goal. Because a big part of your appeal is obviously you're both edgy in the sense.
No, but we don't, Scott, we don't want to be edgy. Like, right. They sort of force you into edginess because you don't, adhere to very, you don't stay within very strict boundaries. So I very much appreciate what you're saying. I would like to think of both of us as compassionate humans. So we appreciate it. And if I respond snarkily or sarcastically, it's just because I have trouble accepting
compliments,
kindness or praise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we're okay people. It depends on the day in my case.
We're awesome.
Yeah. I'm extremely good to my dog. I don't know how I am to people, but I'm extremely good to my dog. Then again, my dog is very cute.
Yeah. Well, I'll just table that for another conversation, what you just said. But let's...
Wait, so that, Hitler, like, Hitler was a dog guy too. Actually, I take that back. Maybe that doesn't have any reflection on how you treat people.
Did we ever establish, like, Hitler is a vegetarian is a logical fallacy? Was he actually a vegetarian? Or is that...
Because I'm a vegetarian, is. So I'm I think curious. I think he was. I think he was like a real dog lover and a vegetarian. I think...
Just...
Yeah.
I was really
just
hoping to get
one of those podcasts
bringing up Hitler. I was really hoping to do that, and the last second, y'all threw me that curveball.
Is that Goodwin's law? What's the law about every?
Yeah, Goodwin's law. Well,
look, I
mean, with Katie, it was a coin flip whether it was going to be a positive or a negative. Whatever, so I mean, we're
let me just return to my wrap up here because I'm trying to be complimentary. You guys, not you two mofos, can take a compliment. I get the sense that your heart's in the right place and that you are the type of people that you speak your mind. Correct me if I'm wrong here, by the way, you want to speak your mind. You want to be free to speak your mind, but I don't sense, and I'm a good judge of character. I'm not sensing nefariousness here. I'm not malevolence. I'm not sensing that from that force from either of you two. And I, and that means something because I do sense that from some people. So
Yeah. I think there's a subset of the people who hate us online who think that it's inevitable that the mask is going to slip and one day I'll like, I mean, not to keep bringing up Hitler, but like come out dressed as a Nazi or something. But there's no there. We just happen to have views that are pretty solidly left and center left. It's just there's no actual controversy lurking under there, to be honest, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I'm pretty upfront about my flaws. I'm not like hiding anything that I'm waiting for somebody to dig up and use against me. It's all out in the open.
Well, what percentage of what you do is motivated by the sheer thrill of saying something that you're not supposed to say? Some people are motivated very, very highly by that, and like 90%, 80%, you can kind of see that. I wouldn't put you guys in the extreme, but I'm wondering what percentage of this is of your podcast is motivated by that sort of thrill.
I don't think there's any thrill involved in it. I want everybody to be able to say the things that they believe. And it's just, he said, I mean, most of our views are very mainstream, almost would have been orthodox sort of liberal views not that long ago. And it deeply disturbs me that those views can now no longer be articulated because some of them are considered like thought crimes or hate crimes. So I would much rather be liked than disliked. Like I think most people, that's just kind of how, like, not how the cards, you know, how the cards ended up falling. But yeah, I don't get a particular thrill out of it at all. I wish that anybody could say, you know, say the truth. And I think, you know, online, I think you see a lot of that sort of being controversial for the sake of it. And I don't think that's what our podcast is. I don't think that's what either of us do in particular.
And what about you, Jesse? I'll give you a chance to talk too.
Finally, I get a chance to talk. I think I've dominated the conversation. There's a little bit of a thrill in just being like cutting through the BS a little bit. I mean, you know, we just released a podcast basically chiming in on Barry Weiss's side on this internal controversy you're not supposed to do on Twitter. But like public opinion on that is probably pretty torn. It's not, I don't think it's even a minority opinion. So I never want to be the guy who's like contrarian for the sake of contrarian or revels in being quote unquote canceled. And a huge amount of the work both of us have done is like in-depth, careful journalism as we see it. So
I agree with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We don't want like the IDW canceled person persona. I would much rather have it be the case that we just had, you know, staff jobs that let us do our journalistic work quietly. But those unfortunately aren't the times we are living in.
Yeah. I think there's this sort of, you know, a number of stories have been written. Like there was a story in the New York Times that featured Jesse and I, this sort of story about cancel culture. I don't want our brand to be like the canceled people. I think that's kind of boring. And I also don't think it's true in our case. I think both of us are doing fine. Despite any sort of attempts to push us out of journalism, both of us are doing fine. I don't want that to be our sort of brand, but it is, I think, what people probably affiliate us with, which is, I don't know. Maybe we can change that if they ever actually listen to our podcast.
Or listen to this podcast chat that we're having. I think it'll be clear to people. So you're not journalists in exile. You're journalists finding other avenues to journal. Lies, whatever the word is.
I mean, people misunderstand this. I left New York Magazine to write a book. It's a mainstream publisher. I still feel like I can pitch to most of the mainstream publications. I increasingly don't want to. I think Katie might be on my page there because, like, you can't pitch anything interesting to a lot of outlets. But it would be better for our brand if we could pretend to be these you know, mysterious canceled exiles. But in no way is that true. It would also be an insult to journalists who are like struggling to pay the bills, which for various reasons, neither of us is.
For what strange reason? Say that again. For what strange reason neither you or what?
No, I'm saying like Katie is married to someone with a job. Have a book I'm writing. Like we're obviously anyone in journalism now is in precarious situation, but I don't want to like sort of leverage this idea that we're canceled.
No.
Yeah.
And I can see why there would be a lot of resentment from people who are like, let's say my former colleagues who have been like covering the civil unrest in Seattle, where, you know, difficult to do, you got to actually be there. And, you know, I can sit in my house and podcast and make almost as much money as they do. I think there's probably a lot of resentment there, which, you know, and I have to say, like, I think what Jesse and I are doing is important. I don't think it's as important as what a local beat newspaper does. I mean, maybe it is right now because this moment is so weird and we're having a conversation that a lot of people feel like they can't have. But we need people to cover the school board. We need people to cover city council meetings. That's real journalism. And that's what most journalism is. It's just not what you see. It's not those people who sort of rise to the top of the you know, sort of the public consciousness. It's narcissists like us.
And I think our brains are in sync because I just made the exact same point. We have a subreddit that someone, a fan, created for us, which was wonderful. And someone basically posted saying, you know, I'm ready to forget the New York Times or move on from it. And in my response, I said, no, like the New York Times, whatever our qualms with it, they do stuff no one else can do, especially now with the decline of local news reporting. So I would much rather live in a world where the Times does better. And I'm glad Katie and I exist as podcasters to make fun of the Times and hopefully, when they deserve critique, when they merit critique, give it. But I don't want anyone to see us as a replacement for mainstream. If I could roll back the clock and have the podcast not exist, but have mainstream journalism be much healthier and have the Baltimore Sun and the Boston Globe and all these other papers still in their former glory, I would do that in a second.
With no income?
No, because then I could get a job at a newspaper. in this fantasy world in which unicorns also exist.
We're basically making the best of a bad situation.
Yeah, the analogy I've been using is like, imagine a ship hits an iceberg, and then as it sinks to the ocean floor, all these bottom-feeding life forms can like take root on the side of the hull and flourish. So that's what
we're the bottom feeders on the iceberg.
On the ship. You guys are great fun. I enjoyed this chat today, and I hope you got a chance to talk about your views and that you accurately were representing your views. And I wish you guys, I wish you well. Am I allowed to say guys now? I really do wish you all well. Congratulations on the success so far, your podcast. And thanks for just being a thoughtful, reasonable group of individuals who are also compassionate.
Likewise, dude. I'd say the same thing about you.
That's very kind. So thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to the Psychology Podcast YouTube channel, as we're really trying to increase our viewership on YouTube. In fact, many of these episodes are in video format on YouTube, so you'll definitely want to check out that channel. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.